Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She's feeling much better and will be back in this chair on Monday. The casino industry is anything but a sure bet these days. Yesterday, the Massachusetts Gambling Commission approved a $1.6 billion casino north of Boston. At the same time, the Trump Plaza just became the fourth casino in Atlantic City to shut down this year. Here to discuss current trends in the casino industry and what its future might hold, Jeff Freeman of the American Gaming Association and Tracy Gordon of the Urban Institute. Joining me from a studio at Harvard, Richard McGowan of Boston College, and by phone from her office at the University of Massachusetts, epidemiologist Rachel Volberg. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Thank
you. Good
morning.
And we want to say
good morning. Great to be with you.
And we want to say a special welcome this morning to our live listeners from WHQR Public Radio, Wilmington, North Carolina, 91.3 FM, a wonderful town, Wilmington, and, of course, the hometown of one of America's greatest broadcasters, David Brinkley. So we're particularly honored to have you with us as regular listeners here on the Diane Rehm Show. Let's start with, Jeff, the state of gambling today. I was looking at the figures. It's a $38 billion industry, but it was in 2007, it was a $38 billion industry. It's an industry that seems to have plateaued and gone through some hard times.
Yeah, actually, we're quite proud of where the industry is today and where it's going in the future. The favorability for gaming has never been higher. Those that embrace gaming as acceptable for them or others has never been higher. You see the results that are being delivered in places like Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Columbus, and beyond. There's a model out there that works. Vegas is...
What's the model?
Well, I think the model that works is one where gaming is one component of a multifaceted economic development plan. Gaming is not the panacea that's going to save an entire state. It's one component. And those that have a strategy to build an economy with gaming as one component of that, where gaming can be an entertainment provider, gaming can be a hub to work with small businesses, gaming can help employ those who have struggled so much since the recession in 2008. If you have a vision, if you have a plan, if you have a diversified economy, gaming can be a great
addition. But New Jersey had all of that. They had a vision, they had a plan, and Atlantic City is in terrible trouble.
Yeah, I think Atlantic City is a great message to other communities and a great juxtaposition with Las Vegas. When you look what's done in Las Vegas, the diversification of that economy, two-thirds of the revenue on the Strip is non-gaming revenue. It's coming from meetings and conventions, restaurants, entertainment programs. Then you look at the diversification beyond the Strip with Zappos, Tesla now identifying Nevada as the place where it's building its next factory. The Nevada economy, the Las Vegas economy, is diversifying. Atlantic City is taking some important steps, but by all accounts, that economy did not diversify early enough. That economy did not take advantage of some of the opportunities that were exposed when this newfound competition came in to Pennsylvania, Ohio, and elsewhere.
Richard McGowan, I want to bring you in because I know you study this issue as well. What lessons are you drawing from this mixed picture that Jeff talks about? Some states doing well, New Jersey a very notable exception, and of course up there in Boston, just the decision yesterday to go ahead with a huge new casino outside Boston. What's your take here?
I mean, one of the things that does strike you is that most of the casinos, in fact, all the casinos are regional casinos for the most part. And so you're really going to just attract people from a region. Vegas is certainly the mecca of casino gambling. So people will come from all over. And as Jeff pointed out, people go there to be entertained totally. If you think about it, it's an interesting bet. That Massachusetts is making, at least the Gaming Commission, thinking, you know, because if you look at the plan that Mr. Wynn has for Everett, he's trying to make it a national destination casino. That's going to be an interesting thing whether that he breaks that out, because one of the things, the revenue he wants is to bring in the really high rollers. And it's going to be interesting if the high rollers would fly over Vegas to come all the way to Boston to go to a casino.
Now, Richard McGowan, I know you're also a Catholic priest, and I want to ask you this question, which is part of the lure of Vegas is it's Sin City, right? What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Does what happened in Everett stay in Everett? Does what happened in Baltimore stay in Baltimore? Is it anything like that same attraction of Vegas, which has a very special mythological place in America.
No, and I think that's the point I was trying to make, is that they're regional casinos. And so, for instance, the Everett one, to be successful, is going to have to get people to leave Boston to go to Everett. Now, it's not that far of a trip, and I think, obviously, again, there'll be other – clearly there are other attractions in the Boston area that people will want to come to see. So that's what – you know,
Mr. Unfortunately for you, the Red Sox are not one of them this year, but
– No, they are not. And, well, but the Patriots might be, and by the way, my Boston College Eagles might be after we beat USC. But, again, there's various things that you have to take into account, and there's where – I mean, the total entertainment package that Jeff talked about has to be established.
Rachel, I want to bring you in because you are there at the University of Massachusetts. I know you've been asked to do a study, and I know it's in the early days. What is your take on the impact, and not only the economic impact that Jeff was talking about, but also the social impact? Just the fact that the state of Massachusetts asked you to do this study, does this reflect ongoing concerns of some of the negative social impacts of bringing in casino gambling?
Well, I think it's important to make the point first that the study that I am heading up here at UMass Amherst is actually required as part of the law that was passed to create casino gambling in Massachusetts.
Interesting.
The statute says that the Gaming Commission must conduct not just a baseline study, but also must monitor the impacts of the introduction of casino gambling over time, and provides for the funding of a public health trust fund as well as a community mitigation fund to minimize and mitigate those impacts as they're identified through the research agenda.
So the answer is yes, they were concerned about this.
Yes, they were concerned, and the idea here is to sort of create a virtuous circle, if you will, of regulating through the use of ongoing empirical evidence of what the impacts are, so that those can be addressed in a sort of a rapid way before they spiral out into things that are so big that they are very difficult to address.
Now, I know that this is still in the early days, but do you have any working hypotheses, at least, of the kinds of social impact you're going to be looking at?
Well, we're going to be looking at a lot of different things. We have both a large number of social and health indicators that we're going to be monitoring over time, as well as a large number of economic and fiscal indicators. The work that we're doing is informed by a theoretical framework for conducting impact studies of gambling that's based on an exhaustive review of the existing literature, and the impacts that we're going to be tracking are all things that have emerged from the past 30 years of research as being of importance,
right,
to monitor over time.
Right. Now, Tracy Gordon, I want to bring you in from the Urban Institute because you focus on the economic impact. And a lot of states, as Jeff said earlier, it's no panacea. Well, that's obviously true because it has not worked as well in many states as people had hoped. Revenues lower, as I read the studies, revenues lower than projections or aspirations in many states. And, of course, the example of New Jersey being particularly in the front burner right now. Give us your take on the economic impact. What's the plus side in terms of development, and perhaps what's the downside or the failures that you see?
Well, I tend to focus mainly on state revenues, and so I would say it's a small but not inconsequential share of state revenues. It's about 2.5%, which might sound very small, but when you're trying to close a budget deficit and you have voters that don't want to increase taxes, that extra increment can come in pretty handy. The other nice thing about gaming revenues is that they tend to be sort of gradually increasing and not really dropping, except for during the recession. There was the first year-over-year drop that we've seen in 2009. That came back in 2010, but mainly because of expansion mentions of gaming, especially in Pennsylvania, which accounted for about half of that mm-hmm. increase. So I would say it's the sort of thing that's not easily dismissed and gotten rid of from a revenue standpoint, but it's certainly, again, as the other panelist was saying, it's not a panacea when it comes to state budget crises.
Now, one of the things you said, Tracy, that's so interesting is this is in a context, right? And one of the contexts is the inability of state legislatures to raise revenue in other ways, given the anti-tax feeling from the Tea Party and other political forces. And does this help enhance the appeal of casino gambling as a source of revenue in a state like New Jersey? New York Governor Cuomo has been talking about this in his State of the State address. Is this part of the context that we have to understand it in?
Right. So you often hear, you know, let's go tax those people that are currently gambling just over the border and get them to come to our states. And I think that that can make a lot of sense in the short term. The problem is that the people who come over the border might decide to go over the border again tomorrow. So you've got states New Jersey, which is now suffering in large part because of competition from Pennsylvania. You know, Connecticut is worried about Massachusetts. Indiana has to look out for Illinois and Ohio. So in economic development, you know, everyone wants to be the next Silicon Valley. And I think in the casino world, everyone wants to be the next Las Vegas. The question is sort of what's in the special sauce? How do you replicate and then keep that success?
Who's the ones who have been most successful?
Well, Nevada certainly gets most of its or the largest share of revenues from gaming, about 12.5% in the last year for which we have data. And it's followed by Rhode Island and West Virginia. You know, I would just say that I don't think people point to, you know, some of those states as sort of paragons for economic development. As we were talking about earlier, you know, you really want to have a diversified strategy. One of the quotes that really caught my eye in the coverage of New Jersey was, we tried to go after industry, but we didn't have the education base. So let's invest in that.
Tracy Gordon of the Urban Institute. I'm going to be back with more comments, your calls, your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the casino gambling industry, with the collapse of casinos in New Jersey, and yet yesterday, announcement of a major new project outside of Boston. Jeff Freeman is with me from the American Gaming Association, Tracy Gordon of the Urban Institute. But by phone from Boston, Richard McGowan, a professor at Boston College, and epidemiologist Rachel Volberg at the University of Massachusetts. We have some lines open, 1-800-433-8850. Give us a call and share your views on this expanding dimension of the American economy, the American entertainment industry. Jeff, I want your take on this question. You mentioned that it's not a panacea. Gaming is part of a strategy. But have some states made a mistake? Have they relied too heavily on it? I mean, New Jersey clearly had very high hopes. And has the industry been overbuilt? Is there a saturation point here where it's like the housing industry? You know, everybody builds houses, and then there are too many of them. Is that what we're seeing?
Yeah, Steve, I think the mistake that could be made today is one of two prominent mistakes. One is relying on the industry to the exclusion of developing other aspects of your economy, expecting the industry to reach some unimaginably high bar here that no industry could possibly meet. That's one potential mistake. Another potential mistake is ignoring basic economics. and thinking that you are still dealing with a novelty situation. As everyone has pointed out, gaming is much more omnipresent today than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago.
I mean, and I remember the figures. In 1988, two states legalized gambling. Today it's 39. I mean, a huge difference.
Sure, yeah. When you include the tribal gaming as well as commercial gaming, you're looking at 39 states. And yet in many of these states, you have public policy that pretends the industry is a novelty, that pretends supply and demand doesn't exist. And that's where you run into tax rates for the industry well over 60%, regulatory policies that inhibit the industry from innovating, from reinvesting, from operating efficiently. We're in an environment now where if you bring gaming into that environment, you're looking for a partner. You're looking for a partner in economic development, a partner with whom you can work in attracting visitors, in building a incredible destination, whether it be regional, as Professor pointed out, or national.
But also, the other point here, and Tracy raised it in terms of giving the figures, that really the other problem you ran into in building this industry was the recession of 2007, 2008. And it's now well known that American wages have plateaued. People are not feeling wealthy in America. All the polls show people quite gloomy about the economy, despite the record on Wall Street. Is this part of the picture that people have to confront, that that the post-recession blues are still inhibiting the kind of spending that might help boost revenues at casinos?
All aspects of the economy that operate as casinos do, other aspects of the hospitality industry, all things that are wants more so than needs, are particularly affected when we get into a recessionary environment. What that means, though, from our perspective, is the industry has to be more competitive. All the more reason we need to be able to reinvest in that product and build the next thing that the customer wants. Bring in those new high-end restaurants. Bring in the most attractive new name when it comes to retail and other activities. If you don't allow innovation at a time when the economy is difficult, you're going to see customers driven to other disposable areas where they can enjoy themselves.
And Richard McGowan, let's talk about another issue. Rachel Wahlberg was talking about how the state of Massachusetts set up this study, clearly concerned, put it into law to monitor the social impact. And from your perspective, are there negative elements that come with the introduction of gaming? The obvious one of some people becoming addicted. We have an email from one listener, Jim in Florida, who brings up the issue of organized crime certainly has been associated with gambling in the past. What's your take on this dimension of the story?
Well, I mean, there's some economic falls. For instance, you can occasionally cannibalize local businesses. Sometimes you can actually help local businesses. The Massachusetts law, by the way, is that the local businesses, the local restaurants and everything have to be invited first to open up restaurants in the new casino, and so in the Boston area. So there'll be actually, legal seafood and places like that will try to open up restaurants. I don't know if legal is definitely, but in other words, there'll be local restaurants. I mean, the social cost, clearly, there can be rises in bankruptcy, increases in divorce rates, things like, and alcohol use. And again, the addiction problem, and Rachel can probably speak much more to this than mine, you have a core morbidity problem there, where people who are addicted to gambling are also addicted to another substance. And so it's definitely, how the state deals with the compulsive gambling issue is vital. And it gives legitimacy to the casino industry.
Do you worry about the social costs?
Very much so. I mean, and I also worry about the economic cost. At the same time, one of the things that does strike me is that sometimes, to be quite honest, the biggest social cost is how states get addicted to the gambling revenue. And for instance, I always – New Jersey got itself in trouble because that revenue was being used to fund Medicaid and Medicare. And so when it went down, the state has all kinds of problems. To me, gambling revenue should be used for rainy day funds. It should not be used for day-to-day functions that the state government should be providing. Gambling revenue should be used for rainy day funds that allow the states to do special projects that, you know, if things go bad, then they can cut. They don't have to raise – excuse the pun here – raise the ante on gambling.
And Rachel, as Richard McGowan just mentioned, and you mentioned earlier in your comment, that you did an exhaustive review of the literature. Having done that, share with us and our listeners what you see from the literature as the red flags here. Jeff Friedman has made the case for the revenue, and it obviously can be helpful in terms of jobs and state revenues. But what are the red flags here that people should be aware of?
So one of the things that the theoretical framework report did that was very useful to us in developing our study was to identify some of the major key positive impacts and key negative impacts. So as Jeff pointed out, and Tracy as well, you know, there are positive impacts in terms of increases in government revenue, increases in public services. The new gambling venues add to the assets of the communities in which they're located. But there are also key negative impacts, and the one that most people focus on and talk about the most is the increase in problem gambling and related indices, the bankruptcies, divorce, suicide, people seeking treatment for various physical and mental health problems. The crime impacts are actually quite complex, and the various studies that have been done have had very different methodologies, mm-hmm. and the results have been quite mixed. There is evidence that casino gambling does contribute to a small extent to an increase in socioeconomic inequality, and there's also, interestingly enough, a documented increase in negative attitudes towards gambling in studies that have looked at the impacts of casino gambling in particular over time.
Okay, thanks. And Tracy, you were nodding your head when Richard McGowan said that one of the serious addictions of states to this revenues, and New Jersey being the case study of sort of the downside here. Pick up on that point and explain what it looks like from your point of view.
Well, I guess I was thinking about his point that they should put it in a rainy day fund. And, you know, I was thinking, good luck with that. I have all kinds of revenue sources that I would love to see put into a rainy day fund, like volatile income taxes, and that doesn't seem to happen. But typically, lottery revenues in particular are earmarked for education. And my concern with that is that it gives voters the illusion that they're off the hook when it comes to funding education. And, in fact, it's a pretty small share. I think New York has the largest share that goes to education, about 5.5%. In California, where I'm from, it's about 2%. And so then, you know, things come along like recessions, education budgets get cut, and voters think, well, wait a minute, we approved that lottery recently. How come the education budget isn't fine? So I think it's a way for policymakers to kind of get off the hook of explaining these tough trade-offs.
Now, you mentioned lotteries, which is not the gaming industry, but it's a form of gambling. When I grew up in New Jersey, the local candy store had 20 payphones in the back, and I couldn't figure out what they were until I realized they were the headquarters of the numbers runners in my hometown. And there's always been gambling in these communities. And if it wasn't official in the state, it was going to happen under the surface, and the state was not going to get any revenue from it. Mm-hmm. So I can see that case. But you're making an interesting point about letting taxpayers off the hook, as mm-hmm. if this somehow is a painless way of raising revenues.
Right. I think it's important to think about all of the costs and benefits, as we've talked about, and we've talked about some of the social costs potentially. The problem is there's just a lot of uncertainty about this. And so, you know, when it comes to the benefits, we want to know how many of those jobs would have existed anyway in other kinds of, entertainment, things like restaurants and bars, and how many of those jobs are going to go away when you put in a new casino, and then how much of it is really benefiting people in the state. Richard mentioned the local restaurants sort of having first dibs. You know, that's a way of trying to keep the jobs in the state, but what if it's an outside contractor that's getting all the money? So these are just the kinds of things you have to look out for and look at.
And also, since you're an expert on tax policy, I want to follow up on another point. The assumption is that lotteries are a regressive tax, that they tax the poor much more than wealthy people, and that's one of the criticisms of them. What's the picture in terms of casinos? I gather it's a little different than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, the concern is this is regressive. Casinos do fall under that category. In general, taxes on consumption are aggressive. People who are low income devote a bigger share of their budget to consumption than people who are high income.
Any kind of a VAT tax or a
Or a sales tax. But casinos of gambling taxes are probably the less regressive. It's the scratch-off games that are really regressive, I think the research has shown, or sort of the instant gratification video lottery terminals that people have some concern about.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Jeff, if we're talking about New Jersey, talking about Massachusetts, sort of two different vectors here, and given the fact that both Richard McGowan and Rachel talking about Massachusetts trying to prepare for this new innovation, if you were sitting down with the governor or talking to the voters of Massachusetts, what would you say in terms of the benefits, and what would you say, I asked the question earlier of Rachel, the red flags. What are the red flags as well as the benefits here?
The first point I would make to anyone considering gaming is understand the facts versus a lot of the rhetoric that's been out there over the years, the antiquated myths, whether it be of organized crime that's been out of regulated gaming for many decades at this point, or whether it be this idea of who the customer is that goes into the casino. The fact is that the casino goer today is a portrait of America, a plurality or earning between $60,000 and $100,000 a year. Three-quarters of them are setting a budget. Most of that is $200 or less.
A budget for what they'd lose.
A budget for how they will enjoy themselves when they're there. You know, is it loss when I go to the baseball game? Is it a loss when I go to the movie theaters? Or is it, am I buying an entertainment experience?
Fair enough. Sure.
And the same is true within a casino. The difference be you have the opportunity to win as well. You know, this customer really is that diversified picture of America. It's a much different image than the myths that have been perpetuated over the years. When you're looking at bringing gaming into the community, the first question you have to ask, Are you willing to overcome that? Are you willing to take a hard look at the law enforcement data coming out of Columbus, Ohio right now, out of Philadelphia, out of Pittsburgh, where it shows actual decreases in crimes since the casinos have come in? You see a much different environment. When you do that as well, are you willing to look at the industry not for every last little bit you can squeeze out of it at the end of the day, but something where you want to build a world-class entertainment center that is the next hub of innovation, of the entertainment experience? And I think too few are looking at it in more of a the way you would have looked at it 20 years ago.
Fair point, and certainly people can get addicted to baseball, too. But at the same time, there is a difference. This is not just another – this is not going to the movies. This is potentially a dangerous addiction for some people. And as Rachel pointed out, there are studies which show divorce, bankruptcy, and other social dangers here. Does the gaming industry have a responsibility in any way to deal not only with the economics but also with the potential social costs?
Yeah, no matter how you slice the numbers, whether it's 1% or some want to use a bigger number of 3% or 5%, no matter how you slice the numbers, more than 90% of those going to casinos are doing so responsibly. Now, that leaves a small portion of people who may not be doing it responsibly. As was pointed out earlier today, some of them have other addictions, perhaps an addictive personality to drugs, to alcohol, to other things. It's important that those people get the help they need. That's why the gaming industry is the largest funder of research in this area. We sponsor or support a foundation, the National Center for Responsible Gaming, that funds research in this area. We're quite proud of the research that's being done, the learning that's taking place. We're supportive of other efforts in this area. We do certainly have a responsibility to make the customer aware, to make our employees aware of how to identify issues and how to prevent things from growing into challenges. We have that responsibility. We take that responsibility seriously, and we're excited to be a partner with people like Rachel Volberg and others for years to come.
Richard McGowan, is this a fair account of the attitude of the gaming industry? Do you find that they are responsible and responsive, or is there more that they could be doing?
Well, I mean, any industry could be doing a lot more. I mean, if for that matter, you could say the cigarette industry and the alcohol industry also should do more for their addiction problems. But the gaming industry, I think, Jeff, that is their Achilles heel. Let's face it. I think that the compulsive gambling issue is the issue that's going to make or break this industry and keep it what we call political legitimacy. And they do support. I was a member of that commission for 10 years, looking at the various projects. And they do support some very interesting research about the gambling complex gambling problem. So the industry but the state also has a responsibility. And for instance, in Massachusetts last year, the state made $971 million on the lottery and gave $250,000 for compulsive gambling. Well, the state has to throw it. Now, in the new gambling law,
you're going to have to hold that thought, because we have to take a break right now. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. Back with your calls and your comments and your questions on this issue of gambling, so stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children. At aecf.org. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the memoir of a man who loses his mother, father, and brother by the age of 24. Then he uncovers a deeply held secret that complicates his grief, but offers hope for another chance at family. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and our subject this hour, casino gambling. With the announcement yesterday of a major new establishment in north of Boston, at the same time, the closing of several major casinos in Atlantic City. So two things happening at once. Jeff Freeman of the American Gaming Association is with me. Also, Tracy Gordon is a tax expert at the Urban Institute. Richard McGowan of Boston College, and epidemiologist Rachel Volberg, University of Massachusetts, both on the lines with me from Boston. And let me read some emails of folks who want to join the conversation. And here's one that came in. I suspect a bait and switch, says Adam. Gambling is sold as a way to raise money without taxes, but who spends the money and who collects it? For every dollar spent in a casino, what proportion goes to a state? Tracy?
Yeah, most of it goes to the state, not very much to the local government. So I hear what the caller is saying in that regard. If you think some of the social ill effects are happening at the local level, it's up to the state to decide whether to remit some of those revenues back to the locality.
So most of the time, it's the state who takes the lion's share of
that. That's right.
And here we have an email from Nat. Would you have your guests weigh in on the aging of America and how the gaming industry plans to adjust? I think the industry will be surprised how gaming is viewed ethically by a new generation. Jeff?
Well, one thing we know is that gaming is viewed more favorably today than it's ever been viewed before. More people than ever view it as something that's acceptable for themselves or others. So as the population ages, I think that younger population looks at gaming, which is more present today, and they see it as just another entertainment source that they need to be responsible with as they would be other areas. But they see it as just another entertainment source. The big question when it comes to aging is, what does the casino look like 10 years from now, 15 years from now, because it probably doesn't look the same as it does today. The machines that people are using, how they interact with that, the social element of it. Obviously, the younger generation today is doing things a bit differently than the older generation, and that's one of the biggest issues on our radar screen. How do we adapt to our customers' changing needs?
And that includes promotion. I mean, all the ads for casinos are young people, you know, drinking far into the night. You know, it's not older people. Don't show up in any of those ads.
Again, when you look at Las Vegas, which is a model that works for Las Vegas, may or may not work elsewhere, 2/3 of the revenue non-gaming from clubs, from restaurants, from retail and other things, much of that attracting a younger population. It's a changing population. One thing we know about the gaming industry, however, is that we can change with that population. We have a history of doing that, of providing people the entertainment experience that they're seeking.
In Richard McGowan, let me read this email from Jim in Florida. When the states of Nevada and New Jersey were facing problems with organized crime and other criminal aspects of the gaming industry, new laws and changes to the industry had to be fought for and implemented. What lessons has the gaming industry learned and will be applying to new expansions to gambling establishments to keep the crime out of gaming?
Well, I mean, one of the ironies is that there's so much money to be made in gaming that, you know, let's face it, the casino firms themselves are fairly large firms, and to keep the crime element out, I mean, I doubt if the casinos themselves, by the way, are certainly not going to cheat customers. There's no reason. They're going to win. In the long run, they are going to win. So in that sense, you know, the crime is the people who would get addicted and who then try to commit crimes to raise more money to go to casinos. And so I don't – again, it's a little bit out of
the – But what about the organized crime element? Now, Jeff said that the industry has dealt with this years ago, but, of course, at least the mythology and the history in Nevada and New Jersey, to take two examples, where organized crime was very involved in the gaming industry.
Well, I mean, I think that the states that you've seen, Pennsylvania and Indiana and Illinois, you really have not heard about any organized crime problems in any of these states. They're pretty – I mean, now, I'll grant you, one license in Pennsylvania was given to a used car dealer who ended up having a felony record. So they're – I mean, the states have to take an incredible long time looking at who they're going to give licenses to and why they're going to give license to.
Okay, let's turn to some of our callers, and we have – let's start with Jason in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Jason.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller. I wanted to share my personal experiences with when we legalized gambling here in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the way we did it was a way that we truly integrated with the local businesses. Like in Ohio, you can't comp your rewards credits for free alcoholic beverages. So instead, what the casino here did in Cleveland, they partnered with all the local restaurants in the downtown area so you could use your rewards credits at the various downtown restaurants. And so basically because of that, you know, people got to experience the restaurants downtown. And I can tell there was a huge difference with the downtown area because before we opened the casino, downtown was a dead zone. You know, ever since we opened the casino, it's been the place to be. And, you know, a lot more people are living there. The shopping malls have expanded. So I feel it, in a way, a lot of ways, while the gambling revenue isn't what we expected it to be, it has helped our downtown.
That's an interesting perspective. Tracy, what's your thought about that?
Sure. I think, you know, there are examples of local economic development, stadiums, you know, other types of investments that do work like that, where you get local businesses back on their feet. The key is just citing those investments correctly, looking at places that are experiencing some slack in their economies, and providing incentives like the caller mentions.
And one of the trends, Jeff, that I gather is to look at cities like Cleveland, Pittsburgh, others, some of the aging industrial cities, as new markets, and not just the places like Las Vegas or Atlantic City.
Sure, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Baltimore.
Baltimore is a huge new casino, isn't it?
Bethlehem, where you have Las Vegas Sands. The industry continues to evolve, continues to offer its product in new ways, obviously. It's not just Las Vegas and Atlantic City. It's not just communities that people are looking for a savior. It's being done in many areas in an urban area. You look at what's being done here in the Washington, D.C. area with the MGM property that will be at National Harbor, just south of Washington, D.C., an already very developed area, a very strong economy, high incomes, and they're going to come in with a jewel of a product that will really make this area even more attractive than it already is.
Let's turn to Lisa in Leesburg, Virginia. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Lisa.
Yes, hi, thanks. Yeah, it's great to think of it as an anchor to maybe promote other businesses that can grow with it. But whenever anybody starts talking about this as an employment opportunity, I always wait for the interview to ask exactly what does that mean? What percentage of the total jobs are going to be minimum wage jobs? How many of them are going to be part-time versus full-time? And when you break down the number of jobs in a casino and you break them down that way, you find that you are hiring an awful lot of very low-income people that even with tips are not going to be tremendous, providers or tremendous contributors to an area economy, because you don't make a whole heck of a lot of money working at these places.
Lisa, thanks very much for that perspective. Very helpful. Richard McGowan, could you answer, Lisa?
I mean, at least I thought, according to some of the statistics, that the average casino worker's salary is a little above the median salary in the United States. And for the most part, casino workers are unionized. I mean, again, the industry is sensitive to that. And I don't know if I necessarily agree with Lisa on that at all. I mean, I will grant you, I mean, right now, I am sure in Atlantic City, there are a lot of unemployed casino workers who can tell you, you know, but they're
thousands
complaining
of
because,
them. Yeah.
Yeah, how about that? And the reason, because they had pretty good jobs and all of a sudden never really wanted to let them go. And so it's an interesting industry that way, because they're willing to allow their workers to unionize for the most part, because because they want to keep labor peace.
Let's talk to Michael in Miami. Welcome, Michael. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. I've noticed that most of the casinos now that are opening are more regional in nature, and it strikes me, I don't have anything to back this up, but it strikes me as there's a lot of skews much older. So going forward, there's all this money being put in the bricks and mortar for casinos. Mm-hmm. How much thought is being put into online gaming, which is really what younger people probably would be much more attracted to than going to a destination that has slot machines?
Thanks for bringing that up, because that was on my list of questions. And Jeff, what kind of challenge to the bricks and mortar casinos, like the ones closing in New Jersey, is online gambling? Give us a sense of this piece of the gaming picture.
Yeah, it's fair to say that there's a lot of thought being put into online gaming, and the industry is a bit divided as to their perspective on the future of online gaming. Many think that it is a great supplement to their brick-and-mortar properties. The rule in New Jersey was that the only companies that could offer online gaming are those that have a brick-and-mortar presence, so it truly is a supplement to what they're doing. There are other companies who don't see the future in online gaming. Because of that, AGA is not taking a central role on the issue, but I can assure you the industry...
AGA, of course, the American Gaming Association.
Yeah, the American Gaming Association isn't out there active on it, but that said, the industry is giving the issue a lot of thought. How do we adapt to that next generation customer? How do they want to consume the product? How do we make ourselves more relevant?
Now, Rachel, as you think about this, having read the literature, but also think about the future, does online gaming present any kind of a different picture in terms of the social costs, in terms of the impact on families? From what you've read in the literature, is it pretty much the same, or are there differences we should be aware of?
Well, I think the main difference in online gambling versus brick and mortar gambling is, you know, sort of the context within which the games are played. So instead of sort of dressing up and going out for an evening or going, you know, to Las Vegas for a week of fun with different amenities, you know, online gambling can be done in your bathrobe, you know, at your dining room table on a computer, or, you know, on your smartphone on the bus to work. So there, the sort of the parameters around, you know, how you can do it and how you can get into trouble are quite different. We also know that the demographics of online gambling are significantly different. I'm involved in a study in Sweden, for example, where online gambling is available through the government operator of gambling services. And what we've seen in Sweden over a number of years is that in addition to involvement in games of skill and betting on sports by the demographic that you would expect, which is younger men, there's also a growing sort of cohort of middle-aged women who play basically slot machines online. And that's been an emerging concern for the Swedish government as the online gambling market in Europe expands much more rapidly than it has here in the United States.
And what's the concern? You know, Jeff made the point that for the perspective of the gaming industry, they see gambling as part of a larger entertainment experience in many places, going to Las Vegas, seeing a show, going to good restaurants. What is the... you seem to be saying that, you know, that solitary gambler in front of her computer in a bathrobe, it's a different experience. And are there different concerns here about the social impact? And hold on to your answer, because I got to do one bit of business. I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead. Go ahead, Rachel.
Oh, I thought you were speaking to someone else. I think that the concern is that, you know, the time constraints and the sort of the you know, Jeff mentioned that many people go to a casino with a budget for what they're willing to spend for that experience. And I think one of the concerns that we have about online gambling and the context within which it takes place is that people may not sort of have the sense that they need to set those limits in place. That said, the potential for setting limits before a person gambles is actually quite high in the online environment. You know, so there are a number of companies and organizations that provide for pre-play setting limits on what you want to spend in terms of money or how long you want to spend online. And those are very interesting to now see them sort of moving out into the brick and mortar operations.
Oh, all interesting points. Let's turn to Robert in Sand Springs, Oklahoma. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Well, thank you. I'm a first-time caller. I live in a state where we have tribal gaming is the most prolific, if not the gaming. And my comment is more or less maybe asking the participants about any sort of comparisons to tribal gaming in terms of success. My observation is I helped develop Lynn's Casino, but with the Osage Nation, when I was working for the city in Sand Springs, but also Creek and Cherokee, seemed to bring, you know, a lot of positive benefits to tribal peoples in terms of educational. And this does drift off into local communities, and I have good examples of that. But yeah, any comments on tribal gaming? I know it's a sort of a change-up, and it could be that Oklahoma is an outlier, but I feel pretty good about what we've done here, and yet all those related issues of, you know, basically gambling addiction, that's true for any place. But I'll, you know, hang up and let you guys comment on tribal gaming as a maybe an outlier, or maybe perhaps some examples that, you know, are a little different from some of the other state-run
Thanks for operation. Thanks very much. Tracy, you looked into this question?
Well, I just have the same worry that I do with education budgets, that something like 55 tribes account for 75% of all gaming revenues for Indian reservations. And so there's a sense after the IGRA was passed in 1988 that tribes have been sort of okay in terms of economic development because of gaming, and that's not necessarily the case.
The other thing is, let's face it, it's just, as Jeff said before, it's Say's law. The supply does not create its own demand. And the two Native American casinos in Connecticut were incredibly successful at first. Now that they've gotten competition, they way overexpanded, and both of them went bankrupt.
Jeff?
Yeah, I would simply add to that that by nearly all accounts, tribal gaming has been successful in delivering great economic benefit back to reservations and to these tribes. They will face the same pressure that commercial casinos face, that local economies face. It's about diversification. There is no such thing as a panacea when it comes to the economy. But we think tribes mimic in many respects the success of commercial gaming in strengthening local communities and putting people to work and putting dollars in people's pockets and at the same time proving that a lot of the myths are just that, myths about gaming.
But it sounds like a theme we've come back to again and again and again is that people have to be realistic, and that at least in the case of some of the tribes, as with some of the states, there have been over expectations about the economic benefits.
Couldn't agree more as we look forward and as we build a stronger gaming industry and strengthen economies in states and communities around the country. Having that realism, having a strategy, looking at gaming for what it is, one component of a multifaceted economic development plan.
Very quickly, Tracy.
Well, some organizations have recommended doing a retrospective review of tax incentives, and I think this would be a prime area to do that. How many jobs actually were created, and should we keep providing those incentives?
Tracy Gordon of the Urban Institute, Jeff Friedman of the American Gaming Association on the phone, Richard McGowan of Boston College, and Rachel Volberg from the University of Massachusetts. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She's going to be back in this chair on Monday. And thanks so much for spending an hour of your morning with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Zurich, providing